Chapter 11. The Rebirth of Gustav Rakatos. Gustav Rakatos had taken to the Afghan program like a duck to water. There was nothing like killing communists to give him a sense of well-being. He had begun helping his old friend John McGaffin on the Afghan task force the same month in late 1982 that Charlie Wilson first discovered the Mujahideen in Peshawar. Just like Wilson, Avrakatos had felt something stir inside himself the moment he met the Afghans. They were killers, and he understood these people. They wanted revenge. Avrakatos wanted revenge, and he liked their food, lamb. That's what Greeks eat. He even liked the Pakistani military men who were running the Mujahideen for the CIA. It didn't take Avrakatos long to throw himself into this operation that was actually drawing Soviet blood, and he soon made himself indispensable to McGaffin. By the middle of 1983, when he learned that his friend was about to be promoted to another job, Avrakatos, who had made something of a cult out of pretending he didn't care about anything, realized that he desperately wanted McGaffin's job. By this time, however, he had made a mess of things, and somewhere deep down he knew that at least part of the reason was because he just wouldn't compromise. There was nothing to gain from telling a powerful division chief to go fuck himself, twice. And there was everything to gain from being a bit more diplomatic in the way he dealt with his colleagues. But Avrakatos had no stomach for this game, and, in a curious way, felt he shouldn't have to play it. He had been recruited to be a street fighter for America, and he was proud to offer his brilliant mind and his ruthless skills to the country that his father had taught him to honor above all else. As he saw it, he was providing something through his work at the CIA that America desperately needed. One night, in a moment of introspection, Avrakatos came up with a historical analogy to explain the role he has played over the years in defense of America. "Have you ever heard of the Janissaries?" he began. "The Turks, when they conquered the Greeks and ruled much of the known world, had an elite group known as the Janissaries. Most were Christians, taken from the best families and made into fanatic Muslims. They were the Sultan's SS. They were his CIA. Every totalitarian regime, every government, every democracy has its equivalent of the Janissaries, people used for missions that no one else wants to touch." This was definitely not the sort of analogy a Yalie at the CIA would have offered to explain why he had joined the CIA, but it was typical of Avrakatos to put forth such a grim analogy. It may not be pretty, but to his way of thinking, there could be nothing more honorable or important than to serve as an elite guardian of American democracy. Even before the run-in with Graver, Avrakatos had come to wonder if the CIA had lost its way, and if there was still a place for a modern Janissary. But when he went to the border in Pakistan that first time, and saw the Afghans loading camels and mules with agency munitions, everything leapt back into focus. This was the CIA he had joined back in 1962. The Afghan operation was still small, but as he realized what was already underway and what these tribesmen were prepared to do if given more support, Avrakatos lusted to take over the program. The CIA is a surprisingly large organization. Although the number of people who work there is classified, it can be said with some authority that there are over 20,000 employees. When it comes time to fill a major operational post like McGaffin's, however, the CIA suddenly becomes a very small and unforgiving place. The only real contenders come from the agency's true inner circle, the clandestine services, that tiny tribe of hand-picked, hard-trained general case officers to which Avrakatos had been admitted in 1962 in spite of his shabby social credentials. These men and precious few women are the ones who organized the overthrows of governments in Iran and Guatemala for Eisenhower, who tried to assassinate Lumumba and Castro during the Kennedy years, who ran the secret wars in Laos for Johnson, who helped overthrow Allende in Chile for Nixon, and who created the Contra Army for Ronald Reagan. They were the ones who even Jimmy Carter had turned to when he'd decided he had to do something about the Soviets in Afghanistan. The number of these elite case officers at any given time is about 2,500, but even this gives a grossly inflated impression. As one veteran explains, "Out of that 2,500, a certain number are simply burned out, or their wives have cancer, or they are the walking dead. Maybe 5% are super, 20% good, and 5% should be shot. By the time you get to choosing an officer for a major post, there may only be two or three serious candidates available. Technically, Gustav Rakatos was in the running. He now had more experience with the Afghan program than anyone at headquarters. But this crude and defiantly uncompromising spirit was simply not a contender, and not only because he had made so many enemies. He just wasn't presentable in the way that Chuck Cogan or Howard Hart or John McGaffin were. And the CIA had powerful reason to be extremely cautious when it came to filling its most visible posts. In the interest of national security, the CIA is given a responsibility that calls for routinely violating the law in the countries where it operates. In any democracy, there is a natural built-in tension over the mere existence of any such organization. It's one of the reasons the American spy service conceals itself and acts as if it doesn't really exist. No government likes to acknowledge what its spies are doing, particularly when it's dirty business. For that reason, there is an understandable impulse to hire men for this line of work who, when seen in public, present a sober, upright image. The idea of Gustav Rakatos, the beer salesman from Aliquippa, interacting with a Saudi prince or even a British MI6 chief was scary enough. But even more frightening was the prospect of such a loose cannon representing the agency in meetings with other branches of the U.S. government, particularly now that the CIA was once again under bitter attack from Congress for its secret war in Nicaragua. The man chosen instead of Avrakatos to take over John McGaffin's post was Alan Fears, the politically astute chief of station in Saudi Arabia, who years later would burst into the limelight when indicted by the Independent Council for his Iran-Contra dealings. He would become infamous in the CIA as the first Judas to turn in another officer in order to save his own skin. But back in the early 1980s, he had caught the eye of Ronald Reagan's exuberant CIA director, William Casey, as one of the agency's leading covert operators. Fears was known as an outspoken anti-communist zealot, a former Marine and college football player under Woody Hayes at Ohio State. Casey was looking for bold, risk-taking officers, and Fears not only passed the enthusiasm test, but he had long since adapted perfectly to the agency's culture. He had a Brooks Brothers appearance and was diplomatic in any setting. All in all, he seemed to be the perfect man for the job. Since Fears's Saudi tour was not scheduled to end for several months, an acting chief had to be found, and no one on the agency's fast track wanted this lame duck slot. The comers all knew that headquarters wouldn't even want a temporary chief to set up liaison relationships with foreign services for fear it would compromise the efforts of the permanent director soon to take over. John McGaffin, either out of respect for Avrakatos or perhaps in a less than helpful gesture to Alan Fears, his bureaucratic competitor, urged Gust to take the post. "Who knows, you're good enough that you may be able to keep the job," he said. With that, Avrakatos began plotting to push Fears aside, keenly aware of the unwritten rule in the Directorate of Operations. If you hold a major post for 3 months as acting chief, it's yours.